Forces, this is an informational meeting, and I'd like to invite the Department of Environmental Quality to come on up for conference. Sorry about my voice. It's worse than I am this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Onan. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I sympathize with the chair because my first overview hearing in the House, I had the same problem. Yeah. So I was having to drink water every other sentence.
Hot tea.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today. I have three handouts, which you already have, and they really cover the things I wanted to cover with you. One is just an overview of DEQ, and then there are fact sheets on our two bills. I'm not going to read through these handouts, and I do like to do things in brief manner, so I will take about 5 minutes to cover some key points about the work that DEQ does, how we are approaching this legislative session, and our proposed legislation. And first, some of the key points about what DEQ does. We work with Oregon communities and businesses to protect clean water, clean air, and clean land. The legislature has given us authority and responsibility to protect clean air and water, clean up toxic spills, and manage the safe disposal of hazardous and solid waste. But what I wanted to emphasize is that we can't do this work and we don't do it alone. We've got partners in this job, and that's citizens, communities, and businesses. And they've invested millions of dollars over the past 30 years to improve pollution controls and clean up discharges. The second point I wanted to point out was we carry out federal environmental laws in Oregon. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the fact that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has delegated authority for us to carry out laws such as the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. They do have oversight authority over how we carry out these laws, so there is a constant dialogue with them about how they think we're doing. And then they do have separate enforcement authority under these federal laws, so when from time to time you may hear about EPA coming into Oregon, it's because they can and sometimes do. We also work locally, and we've found that having field staff in more than 15 offices around the state helps us better understand local problems and provide better service. That's something we did in 1993, and we've found that it's working very well. And then finally, we are regulatory, and we do often deal with difficult environmental problems that involve businesses and local governments and citizens. Our director, Stephanie Halleck, expects us to do excellent work, to be fair and equitable in how we implement and enforce regulations and solve problems, not just run programs. So that is how we're doing our work. Now, how are we approaching this legislative session? We do recognize the immediate challenges to Oregon's economy, obviously a big thing on everybody's mind. We are still committed to our priorities to protect people's health and Oregon's environment. At the same time, we recognize that state priorities include things like getting Oregonians back to work and streamlining regulatory processes. So when we looked at coming into this session, we kind of came at it with three principles. I don't have this in any handout, but there's three basic ways we're coming into this session. The first is, where we can, we want to enhance services that make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon. We already have, and we're continuing to seek efficiencies and process streamlining while maintaining environmental protection. At the same time, and this is something you'll see in the bills we're proposing, a certain level of resources is needed so that we can issue permits and we can carry out the work that's needed to help businesses do what they need to do. The second principle is to maintain environmental accomplishments to protect public health and clean air, water, and land. The first fact sheet that I handed out, which is just an overview, does point out that the investment that's been made in our air and water over the past 30 years has made our air and water cleaner. And we believe it's important to the economy and to the environment to maintain this success. The third principle is keeping delegation of federal regulations so the state, not the federal government, carries out environmental laws in Oregon. And then moving to our two legislative proposals, they're really based on these three principles. The second page of your handout is Senate Bill 196. This bill has been referred to your committee. We're still working with stakeholders on some last details, so when it's ready, we hope to bring it to you. The main goals of this bill are to first keep delegation of the Federal Hazardous Waste Program, and second, to continue to help businesses understand and comply with hazardous waste laws. Really briefly, what is hazardous waste? Well, there's a very technical definition in statute and rules, but it's waste chemicals or byproducts that can harm people or the environment if not managed safely. And then the hazardous waste program is carried out under the Federal Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. It is complex. It is stringent. It's a set of regulations and permits for storing, transporting, and then ultimately disposing of hazardous waste. Last year, we realized we'd have a significant revenue shortfall because this program is largely fee-funded. We convened a work group of stakeholders, including fee payers, industry, small business, local government, environmental groups, and EPA was also attending. The group recommended that we streamline some of our existing work, that we do increase the fees, and this fee increase is only to fund work that's required by EPA to keep Oregon running the program. The third piece, which is really the most controversial and which we're still working out the details on, is that we do have something that is not required by EPA, which is state-only. We have chosen, and the legislature actually directed us several biennia ago, to provide technical assistance to small businesses. And this is to help them be in compliance, help them know what they have to do, and in some cases help them save money by reducing their use of toxics. Right now, the funding for that has been going down over the past biennia. And to keep that work going, although not even at the same level it is at a reduced level, the work group recommended dedicating penalties from hazardous waste violations. That's about $350,000 a biennium to fund this work. Obviously, there are a couple issues with this. One is diverting money from the general fund is obviously an issue. And then the second one is just a concern about, is this appropriate to do with DEQ penalties? So we're continuing to talk to folks about that. The last page of your handout is Senate Bill 197, which is fairly straightforward ratification of fee increases for air and water programs that were approved in our budget last session. We went forward and did by rule during the interim, and now, as the law requires, we're coming back and asking for those to be ratified. There are no increases or changes in the fees. And they do support, again, our permitting and technical assistance work for businesses, so we would hope that that would be supported. If there's any interest topic that interests you, I could certainly bring some of our experts to talk to you about those in more detail. But I'll stop there and see if you have any questions. Thanks.
Are there some questions this morning? Yes.
Yeah, I see in your front page on your fact sheet it says that 13,000 miles of rivers in Oregon fail to meet the clean water standards. Can you tell me, is that mostly because of the temperature standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, in fact, you're right. I don't know the exact number. I could get the exact number if you'd like, but most of that is for temperature. And the temperature is, under the Clean Water Act, is classified as a pollutant. And
Mr. Chair, is there any attempts to change the standards with the recommendation, I believe, recently that the temperature standards were completely unrealistic for most of Eastern Oregon rivers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there is something going on right now which is probably going to have an effect on it, and we don't know where it's going to come out, but the Environmental Protection Agency is looking at temperature standard not just for Oregon but other states in what they're calling a regional temperature standard. And that's one thing, again, when I was mentioning that there is federal oversight, DEQ has set a temperature standard for the state, but that was approved by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they can make recommendations or even adopt their own if they don't think we did a good job. So it's obviously a complex area. We're constantly involved with dialogue with everybody on this because it's clearly a difficult thing to figure out how we're approaching temperature. And the way we approach them is in our total maximum daily load program, where we set pollution loads for streams that don't meet standards. We're basically saying, yes, there's a number out there, but the most important thing is where we need to reduce streams that are too hot. And so let's try to see if we can use best management practices to make it better and kind of monitor that over time and use adaptive management to see how, and that's the goal, is to get these streams more healthy.
All right, follow up on that. So just to be clear from what you said, DEQ set the standards and the feds ratified it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct.
So is there any movement at the DEQ level then to set realistic temperature guidelines and ask the Fed to ratify that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I can find out. We do have Every 3 years, again, under the Federal Clean Water Act, we have to look at our standards. And we have a group of stakeholders looking at certain standards now. I don't know where temperature stands on that kind of schedule of looking, so I can find that out and let you know.
Please do. Okay. Let me ask a question about this side of the mountains. I know Eastern Oregon's temperature has been a big deal for a long time. On this side of the river, what percentage of the rivers fail to meet clean water under the temperature standard, and what percentage is more likely to not meet it because of actual pollutants in the water?
Mr. Chair, I hope it's okay if I get back to you on that. I don't have those exact numbers with me.
Yeah. It's just an interesting question to me. I mean, I have anecdotal kind of input running around Portland all the time. And, you know, as long as we've got sewer overflows and everything else in Portland, well, obviously we're not meeting anybody's standards. Yet I want to know what it's like upriver and so on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I think those of us have been dealing with that issue over a long period of time find the same situation as they find in Eastern Oregon, and that's, I guess, a question that I would like to ask is why there's an absolute insistence on accepting standards that never have been met in those rivers and streams all back through time. And it makes absolutely no sense to require some of the temperatures during the summer months. There needs to be some kind of a variable that would allow for periods of time. You know, we get times when we'll have a summer that will run, you know, 75, 80 days at around 100 degrees all the time. We'll have other summers when we have intermittent times when things cool down considerably and we get some rains and stuff like that, and there's a definite variation. And basically, as I can see it in the TMDLs, there's absolutely no variation allowed or no acknowledgement that... Certain weather conditions and weather patterns change it in a definite manner. And having now spent over 60 years in the Northwest at times when we enjoyed a lot of playing around in the streams and stuff like that, I can speak at least for Eastern Oregon that they never did maintain a 64 degree temperature through the summer months in many of those streams over in the eastern part of the state.
Excuse me for interrupting, Senator Fisher, but do you have a history of temperature standards back through several years at DEQ? I mean, as I listened to the Senator talk, I thought about the fact that years ago, maybe when there was more trees along the streams and so on, it might have been cooler because of the shade. We've heard that many times in our...
You can go over to Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, and hunt for trees, and you're going to be having more trouble if you're trying to find gold.
Well...
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, two things. One is, if there's an extreme, it sounds like there's a lot of interest in this topic, and I would be happy to, if you would be interested, the person who could answer all these questions better than I can, and it is a very complex area to understand. It's always a struggle to explain. I sympathize. Mike Llewellyn, our water quality administrator, if that's something that you'd be interested in exploring this topic, I can answer some of your questions, but certainly not a lot of the technical details. The second thing is I can find out about history. Usually how we approach total maximum daily loads is we're on a schedule to complete those, and we're under a court order to complete those by a certain date. And that means we're working on certain stream basins around the state, and we're collecting data either at that time. There's a lot of data collection and monitoring information that goes into developing those. We also use information from other sources where that's available. So I would expect that information that, such as you asked for, would vary depending on what information was already collected in the past and what we might be doing now. Interestingly, I do know The Willamette, for example, is one where there's probably a lot more information just because of the history of what's been done on that river. And there were records that somebody was looking at in our office where I think there was temperature data from many years ago. That's probably one of the ones that would be most likely. And the other thing about temperature is to realize in rivers like the Willamette, there are also point source discharges, and that's something that where Oregon has done a great job. In the past, you know, before Clean Water Act and before Oregon set standards for cleaning up the Willamette, things were not treated at all, and that would include temperature if you had hot water being released in the river, and that's something that's gotten a lot better over time. But I can certainly find out information about what we've got historically if that would be interested, and then please let me know if you'd like, you know, the water quality experts and the temperature experts to come and talk about this more.
It's an issue that keeps coming up, and I'm sure that there will be some further discussion about it. I wanted to change the emphasis for just a minute. You have an interesting paragraph at the very end of your first page. It says, Oregonians' daily activities, such as driving our cars, fertilizing our lawns, constitute more than 80% of the pollution of air, land, and water. Has that been a constant through the years?
Mr. Chair, no, I would think not. two reasons. One is, as I just said, pollution from wastewater treatment plants or businesses or industrial sources wasn't treated, and we've gotten so much better at that those are highly treated now, highly regulated. So that's been largely cleaned up, although there's still some work to do on some areas. And secondly, Oregon's population has grown, obviously not so much in some areas as others, but for example, in the Portland metro area, the biggest air pollution problem we have is from cars, and that will continue to be the case. And again, for our water, because most of the what we call point sources have been highly regulated for a long time, what we see is the runoff causing most of the problems. So those are much harder to get a handle on. You can't really approach them from the same regulatory way that you do pipes. And so we're looking at different ways to address that, and it's something we certainly struggle with. And I think it mostly involves, at this point, education and outreach activities to try to help people understand what they can do to be a part of the solution.
So my question then would become, were we once at 90% instead of 80%? You know, where were we?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. This is based on recent information that we've put together.
Because it begins to define how much impact DEQ and the regulations really have if we were able to move from 90 to 80% because of your effort.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's just some of us want to work at. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I guess I need some clarification. My understanding, by Lori's explanation to your question or answer to your question, was it would have been lower than 80% in the past because prior to when there was pollution coming from pipes out of factories directed into the water and smokestacks from factories going direct into the air, most of the pollution or more of the pollution was coming from point source solution.
I thought that was under the heading of land. You see what I'm saying? Pollution. But
I can certainly look more into that and just see if we have some good statistics.
When did DEQ come into existence?
Well, Mr. Chair, very interesting. 1938, but it was then known as the State Sanitary Authority, and it was created by an initiative to clean up the Willamette River.
Okay. And that's the point is, you have some records back to 1938.
Mm-hmm.
You would see differentials all over the place. I mean, point source on farms would have been higher earlier, and those have been regulated and come down. There were less automobiles, so that might have been lower, certainly. And it's higher now. You know, it's just kind of how much effect do your regulations have is kind of the question I'm trying to get to. You know? Are there other questions? I don't want to keep you here grilling you. I was interested in Senate Bill 196, what happens if it doesn't pass. You're saying that the EPA could take back the program and we could lose jurisdiction. Is that what you're saying there?
Mr. Chair, that is a risk. EPA has been involved in these discussions, and the question for them with our programs is always, do you have enough people to do this, the base work that we think you need to do? And staffing in this program has been reduced over the years as it is, and with this particular revenue shortfall, it would, if we didn't get at least the fee increase, it would, I think, I'm going to just from memory say, I think it's 10 staff that's covered by that. So I think it's a, it is a definitely an issue.
Given all the federal cutbacks, would they have the staff to do it either?
Mr. Chair, they don't want to take programs back, but you know, at some point they decide that they have to. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
Do all states have a similar to our DEQ, or some regulated by the EPA?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, some states are regulated by the EPA. They do not have a state.
Are they states that have all their strings tied up with water pollution from temperature problems and all that kind of stuff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I don't know the specifics of which states have what issues. If you're interested in that, I can certainly find out some more.
Well, you know, I just keep coming back to the fact that every single thing we get from state government has increased fees, increased fees, increased fees. We can't get the work done. We can't get the other done. Does anybody in state ever stop to consider that some of the businesses don't have the money that they once had to be paying these fees?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, we indeed do. We realize it's a problem, and we do have discussions with these folks, and that's why we had all through the interim a work group to say, okay, here's our problem, and what are you willing to do? And they did, it was, you know, numerous FTE charts and showing what work was done. They have recommended some streamlining, which is going to reduce the need to increase the fees somewhat. But yeah, we realize it's an issue for businesses, and it's not something we take lightly. We haven't increased fees in this program since 1997, so this is the first fee increase for this since 1997.
Your work groups included all the stakeholders, the businesses, and so on. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, we included a representative from all of the different interests that would be, but not certainly every single stakeholder. Right. But the different interest groups that are involved with this program.
And they were basically supportive?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just to comment, I still wonder if we'd be all that bad off, judging by what some of the other states are doing in relationship to their work with the EPA, if we let some of this stuff go back to the EPA and let them do a little bit of struggling with where the money comes from.
Be interesting to have a kind of a scenario developed as to what would happen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, just one comment. Oregon has had a tradition of supporting Oregon doing the work instead of feds, and right. It's something that our stakeholders have felt pretty strongly about. So obviously you'd want to check with those folks and see where they were coming from. And if this bill gets heard here, hopefully they'll come and speak to that.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Mike, glad to have you come this morning from the Department of Energy. I can tell that everybody is really enamored with DEQ and the Department of Energy. I think three people have shown up. You guys have really set a record up against the teacher.
Is you?
Yeah, well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. For the record, I'm Mike Graney. I'm Director of the Oregon Office of Energy. I want to take about 10 minutes this morning and talk about a couple things. First, I want to briefly just give an overview again, remind the committee members what our primary functions are. Second, I want to talk about the response that to the energy crisis of 2 years ago. The legislature passed a number of important bills that enabled us to work with power companies, private power developers, individuals, businesses, and schools and others to respond to the energy crisis more effectively. And third, I want to talk about briefly a few issues that I see coming ahead in the future. We add that we have no energy bills that we've pre-session filed ourselves, largely because of the bills that you passed last session and the implementation of those, but there are some issues looming ahead I think we'll want to look at. First, what we do generally, we have three primary missions. First, to assure a stable supply of energy, and we do that through a number of ways, most directly through the siting of energy facilities. There's a 7-member citizen panel, the Energy Facility Siting Council, that makes the decisions on energy siting. We provide technical review of the applications and technical support for the council. Secondly, we encourage energy conservation and renewable resources, clean energy resources, as a way first of helping consumers respond to price hikes, the cost of power goes up, using energy more efficiently and having alternative sources of energy available helps them to respond in a way that can help them economically, help businesses operate more efficiently and withstand the economic pressures that high energy costs bring, and also benefits the environment. Finally, we're responsible for regulation of shipments of radioactive materials through Oregon and the cleanup of radioactive waste in Oregon. There have been a number of sites in Oregon that we have cleaned up over the years. A mill tailing site in Lake County. There are two abandoned uranium mines that we're working on right now. We'll be responsible for decommissioning the Trojan nuclear plant that's been closed. And we're also representing the state's interests on Hanford. Hanford's in the state of Washington, but presents enormous risks to the Columbia River and to other interests of Oregonians. Let me first turn to the legislature's response to the energy crisis. And there's a memo here that I have, a two-sided memo, that talks about the bills that the legislature passed last session. It passed two major bills dealing with energy siting to simplify and speed up the process of siting large energy facilities, Senate Bills 843 and House Bill 3788. And you also passed two bills that made important changes to our two of our most important energy conservation programs, Senate Bill 520 and Senate Bill 521, dealing with the residential energy tax credit and the business energy tax credit. And sometimes it's hard to pinpoint the effects the legislation has, but in these cases, we really saw dramatic changes almost immediately. There were other reasons why the energy supply situation in the region has improved over the last 2 years, but these play a key part in Oregon's contribution. Let me first turn to the energy siting situation. The plants that had been previously approved by the Siting Council and that were under construction, almost 2,000 megawatts, have come online in the last 2 years. That's 2,000 megawatts is equivalent of 6 or 7 natural gas power plants. Most power plants being built these days are about 300 megawatts in size. In addition, since the legislation was passed 2 years ago, our Siting Council has approved another 2,000 megawatts of energy facilities, and 225 megawatts of that are already operational, and additional power plants are being built. On the conservation and renewable resource side, the businesses in the last 2 years invested nearly $100 million each year in energy conservation projects, 1,000 projects each year. And that's more than double the level of investment they had done in prior years. On the residential side, we had over 20,000 individuals each year in the last 2 years invest over $12 million in energy-efficient appliances, solar hot water heating, and alternative fuel vehicles. In addition, we've issued $16 million in new loans through our small-scale energy loan program for energy conservation and renewable resources. We have another $50 million pending that will be issued likely very soon. So these all had an impact, combined with steps that the other Western states took in the region, with Washington and California especially, with power plants being built in their states, with the increased hydro situation. The weather situation improved dramatically over the last year and a half in terms of the hydro supply. Our power supply system is stabilized, and with that, the wholesale price of power has come back down to more normal historic standards. I'd like to be able to say that the price of power to individuals would drop, but that's not going to happen, unfortunately. The retail price, I think, will continue to rise in the future, but hopefully we will not see the type of horrific price spikes that caused severe disruption and cost us thousands of jobs in the state 2 years ago, as companies in many cases could not afford to increase the price of power from the wholesale markets that occurred at that time. One of the other things we've been doing is working closely with the Attorney General's office and the Public Utility Commission on investigations of the cause of those overcharges. While the wholesale market is generally unregulated by FERC, there are standards that must be met in terms of fair and reasonable rates and non-predatory standards for pricing power. Recently, we reached a settlement with one of the companies that's being investigated, Williams Energy Company, that will result in $15 million being returned to the state of Oregon. And that's the use of that money is under the terms of the court settlement is something the Attorney General will determine soon, but it's for general restitutionary purposes to Oregon consumers and Oregon ratepayers. There are additional cases pending, and in fact, under the terms of the settlement, the Williams Company, while admitting no wrong, has agreed to cooperate with the state in examining the practices of the other companies that were involved in the wholesale market. So this could lead to additional refunds coming back to Oregon as well. Unfortunately, it won't offset completely the damage that was done at the time of the wholesale market prices, but it will certainly help. Secondly, let me mention one other source of energy that we're particularly interested in. And so I have a handout here that I don't think I gave to the committee staff. I apologize for that. With the committee being both an agricultural and natural resources committee, I thought you would be interested in the work on biomass energy. Biomass energy is, and by that we mean energy from forest waste, forest products, farm products for energy, has played a significant role in Oregon. In fact, about 10% of Oregon's consumption of energy is what we call biofuels, and that includes things such as direct heat for mills, for lumber mills using waste wood products, generation of electricity, process heat, hot water used from energy, methane production from wastewater treatment plants. There's a number of sources, a number of uses. In fact, it constitutes about half of the use of natural gas in Oregon, so it plays a significant role. It has some environmental benefits and economic benefits as well, and it's one of the renewable resources that's eligible for our incentive programs that we want to continue to encourage the use of. One of the things as well is there was an interim task force on bioenergy looking at the use of biomass for fuels, for transportation fuels, such as ethanol and biodiesel. And that's an area that we haven't seen much of in the state previously, and that task force may come out with some legislative recommendations for further encouragement of those fuels, which we would like to see as well. Let me turn to a couple of other issues I see coming ahead. We have no legislation, as I mentioned, because we think the legislation that you passed last session is working. It's working well, and they were major changes in our programs that took us time to work through with the different developers and industry and consumers that we work with. But there are some issues that I think are important facing all of us, not necessarily in terms of legislation. One is we have continued dependence both as a state and a nation on imported oil, especially in the transportation area. And in many respects, that's a national problem that we cannot address, obviously, individually, state by state, but has an enormous impact on the cost of all energy and pressures on the other types of energy. Price of natural gas, which we use very very much in this region for electricity, is very directly tied to the world price of oil. And continues to be affected by the price of oil. The amount of dollars spent on energy in the transportation sector is about half of all the energy consumed and the price of energy consumed in Oregon. Those dollars, almost all of them, eventually go out of state because there's no in-state oil industry. So the extent we can encourage less consumption of petroleum fuels, the extent we can encourage alternatives like biodiesel and ethanol that may have a local agricultural component or a local forest and farm component, those are benefits to Oregon and to the economy. We also have, I think, a serious question of transmission line capacity. And again, that's a regional issue. But we have, as these new power plants are coming online, we have seen bottlenecks in the transmission system. Some of that is being addressed currently by the Bonneville Power Administration and a region-wide coordinating group that we participate in. But there are problems with financing the transmission expansion that's needed. There's issues about who gets priority. And it's been particularly an issue for some of the more promising wind sites that would be developed. These sites, of course, have to be where the wind is, and we have a number of sites in northeastern Oregon, in Umatilla and Morrow and Grant counties, that could be very large wind sites. By that I mean 300 to 500 megawatts. And most of the wind sites we've seen have been much smaller than that. But they are a ways from the transmission grid. They will need transmission access and supplemental lines. And that's an issue that we're looking at as well. Finally, I think that we we're currently in a good situation in terms of energy supply, but there is concern that 4 or 5 years down the road we could be looking at a repeat of the situation we had 2 years ago. We're seeing a situation that some of the power plant approvals in Oregon and in other western states, receiving a license to build a power plant doesn't guarantee that the power is going to be built. We're starting to see more and more power plant approvals just kind of being put on the shelf. And there's a number of reasons for this. There's difficulties with financing in the market. There's the whole industry has been shaken up and had direct impacts from the Enron situation. But there's a lot of uncertainty in the timing of when power plants are going to be coming online. And combined with the unpredictability of price of fuel, there are some potential serious issues out there. So to the extent, again, that Oregonians can help, we can't control all of that, but we can certainly cushion ourselves through the wise use of the energy resources we have, through efficient use of energy, and through diversifying our energy resources. And that's a large part of what we see our mission as, trying to help Oregonians do. Let me just mention, too, there are a couple of additional handouts that you have. One is this report is a short report on the radioactive material transport in Oregon. We had about 200 shipments of radioactive materials through Oregon last year. And that's actually down some from what we've had in previous years. Most of that material has been what we call low-level waste. There's likely to be increased shipments if the Hanford cleanup effort moves forward, and the nature of those shipments is likely to be more different kinds of waste, which presents different risks than low-level wastes. One of our missions is to work with emergency responders along the transport route to train them and provide them equipment so that if there's an accident in shipping, they know how to respond and can respond quickly and safely. And the Federal Department of Energy has worked with us very closely the last few years to make sure that that happens, and that's a continuing effort that we do. The other document I left you is our biennial energy plan, and that gives first a more thorough explanation of what the state has done to respond to the energy crisis of 2 years ago. It also has a good primer of what our energy consumption is like, just general background information for you by energy source and type and fuel use that hopefully will be of help. And then we've provided more detail on some of the issues there that I've listed for you, as well as some other issues that we see in the future. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions or elaborate further on any of this.
I wanted to ask a couple questions. But I wanted to make a comment first. I followed one of these trucks down the highway. Kind of thrilling to follow a regular truck, you know, on the highway.
Your clothes.
Yeah, right. It was really lit up my weekend. I was surprised how fast this guy was going. Do they regulate the speed at which this kind of material can be transported? More than a regular truck, or can it just do what most truckers do? Once it's on the truck, they just out there and go.
Mr. Chairman, they're supposed to. The speed is an issue, and for the spent fuel and other high-level waste materials, there's actually what they call governors on the trucks that will limit their speed.
Okay.
If this truck was going very fast, it probably was low-level waste, but still they need to follow the speed limit, and they need to, because one of the low-level waste covers a broad multitude of materials. It's sort of definition by exclusion, and some of it is stuff that's almost completely harmless, and other types of low-level waste as material that you need a protective suit to approach. And that's part of what we deal with the shippers and the emergency responders, is notification of what type of material is in each shipment, so they'll know how to respond if there is an accident.
My other question is that I've heard for years, you know, the wind farms and stuff are too expensive. They're not, you just can't get the price down to a level where electric generated on a wind farm can compete with other. And I never quite understood that, because, you know, your natural resource in this case is wind, and it doesn't cost you anything. I mean, gas costs you something,
right,
et cetera. Why is it that the price of this remains so high?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first, that is changing. It's changing very dramatically. As the new technology of wind machines is producing energy much more cheaply and is virtually competitive with natural gas now in many locations. The price has been controlling because of simply the cost of generating electricity from a spinning turbine. The technology to do that was very inefficient. And so your price per kilowatt hour or price per megawatt hour was very high. And the volume of energy produced for the cost of installation traditionally was much higher than other energy resources. Now that has changed. And the machines that are at state line on the Oregon-Washington border north of Pendleton there, and other sites. We have some smaller sites near Wasco and near near Heppner are producing energy at a price that's with a production tax credit incentive is cost competitive now with natural gas. That federal production tax credit is very important, and that's been the extension of that has been a major priority for the state. Congress extended it for 2 years, but I think we need a long-term extension so that developers will have the assurance that that tax credit is there. With that tax credit, then wind now is competitive, and we have been approached by at least two developers who are seriously thinking of applying for state approval for plants that would be 300 to 500 megawatts wind plants in that northeastern Oregon area.
Will there continue to be further refinements and improvements? I mean, you're saying it's almost competitive now with the tax credit. Can we get to the point where we could be competitive without a tax credit?
Mr. Chairman, over the long term, I hope so. I think there will be improvements. The efficiency of these machines has improved enormously, and the size has changed a lot, and the impacts on land use have been minimized compared to what they used to be.
Can you explain that a little more for me?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, some of the early sites, especially in California, they were smaller in scale and required many, many more towers and spun faster and were sited in places that resulted in a lot of bird kills. And that was a serious issue for many people. The wind machines now, it's been slower. They're taller, so you can continue farming, for example, under the wind turbines. In fact, the farmers view this as a real asset because they're provided a payment each year for permission to site the towers on their land. They've been sited in places that generally don't have ground prey, and with that, then we don't have the bird problem. And the spinning speed of the turbines themselves is much slower, and that presents less of a hazard to any birds that would be in the area. So the plants that have been sited in Oregon so far have been able to deal with the bird issue satisfactorily.
Thank you. It's a fascinating area.
It really is. It's such a change from 20 years ago.
Is technology moving similarly with regard to photoelectric, I mean, photocells?
Mr. Chairman, it is. The cost issue in terms of photovoltaics is still significant, although in some cases, in especially rural Oregon, it is cost competitive versus if you have to pay for the cost of extending normal utility lines. Let's say you're building a new area that's not served by currently by electricity, and in those cases, it is cost competitive.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Any questions? I thank you for coming this morning. That completes our agenda. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wait a minute. I want to make that announcement. Nobody's here to hear the announcement. Everybody here knows the announcement.
Okay.